Today is Monday, September 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, Hurricane Dorian brought devastation to the Caribbean as it made landfall Sunday night.
This is probably the most saddened and worst day of my life to address the Bahamian people.
Also ahead, the latest on the protests taking place in Hong Kong, and with lawmakers scheduled to return from summer holidays in Britain, the fight over Brexit is poised to heat up. Those stories and more are all coming up next. The second strongest Atlantic storm on record pounded the Bahamian islands of Great Abaco and Grand Bahama on Sunday night and into Monday when it was a Category 5 storm. Hurricane Dorian is forecast to move dangerously close to the U.S. state of Florida in the next 2 days. Reuters' Ryan Brooks starts us off.
The second strongest Atlantic storm on record left a trail of destruction in the Bahamas on Sunday. Hurricane Dorian is a catastrophic Category 5 storm, expected to drop up to 30 inches of rain on the Caribbean country.
Look at this. We need help, everything now.
Video posted on social media showed a landscape of strewn power lines and splintered wood. Prime Minister Hubert Minnis went on national television ahead of the disaster to urge citizens to prepare.
This is probably the most saddened and worst day of my life to address the Bahamian people. And I just want to say that as a physician, I've been trained to withstand many things, but never anything like this. We're facing a hurricane, Hurricane Dorian, one that we've never seen in the history of Bahamas. Wind velocity as high as 180 miles per hour, with gusts in excess of 200 miles per hour.
But Dorian is whipping up more than wind and rain. It's also expected to bring storm surges up to 7 meters or 23 feet high. That's higher than the average roof in the Bahamas. Meanwhile, the storm is expected to head dangerously close to Florida. The U.S. state is ordering evacuations along its coast, although some are choosing to stay put, including one couple who called their boat home.
I will not get off this boat during the hurricane for any reason at all, save a human life.
Evacuation orders are also rolling out along the coast in South Carolina and Georgia. Dorian is forecast to remain a hurricane for the next 5 days.
That was Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks. Ken Graham at the U.S. National Hurricane Center provided this update earlier today as the Category 4 storm approached Florida.
Looking at some of the stats, the winds are 155 miles an hour, so still a powerful hurricane and still about stationary, moving west at 1 mile an hour, just very stationary. And the current location about 110 miles east of West Palm Beach, Florida. Let's start off with that radar. You can see the very pronounced eye over the same area for a prolonged period of time. So that means continued rainfall. Could see 30 inches of rain throughout the Bahamas. And listen to this, the surge could be 18 to 23 feet in some of these areas around the winds. And just battering winds, rain, and the storm surge, just a devastating situation, life-threatening situation throughout the Bahamas. But in Florida, you can start seeing these outer rain bands start to impact portions of Florida. And in there, heavy tropical rains. You can also see 40 or 50 mile an hour wind gusts in some of these rain bands. So you have to really watch that with time. Could be real dangerous. And also look how far away. It's a running theme. We keep talking about these impacts well away from the center, and you can see the impacts pretty far away. So we've got to watch that as the system moves to the north. Look at the forecast. Not much change in that forecast. So a couple things to look at here. We've extended the hurricane warning along the coast of Florida, and we also have a hurricane watch now that extends into Georgia. So that means conditions could get hurricane force with time here, so we'll have to watch for the winds. But let's look at the forecast. First, let's start with the size of the winds. When we talk about the size of the winds being about 120 to 130 miles away from the center, these are tropical storm force winds, hurricane force winds stretching out 30 or 40 miles, so we can't concentrate just necessarily on this track. And notice our official forecast, doesn't even have that center line, because we want everyone to focus on the actual impacts well outside that cone. So look at this. We have the cone still over portions of Florida, so you still could see some small changes in that forecast. Anywhere in here, you can see the center with time, but let's not focus exactly where that center is, because the reality is you're still going to get impacts. You're still going to get the rain. You're still going to get the wind with time, and still a hurricane we're going to deal with the rest of the week and even into next weekend. So let's look at some of those impacts. One is storm surge. Half of the fatalities in tropical systems comes from the storm surge. So a dangerous situation, 4 to 7 feet possible in some areas, not every area, but some areas. And independent of that track, you can get some of those high levels. And a lot of that could come even well before the wind. So be careful. If the local officials tell you to leave, make sure you leave. And also the rainfall. We'll watch for this rain. A little change in the track, you can get a much more higher levels of this rain. So you have to watch for these small changes. This has been Ken Graham right here at the National Hurricane Center.
Hong Kong saw more protests over the weekend, and today, high school students gathered in a park on what was the first day of the new school year in a strike to show their continued support for the pro-democracy movement. Joining me on the phone with all the latest is Hong Kong-based journalist Aaron Hale. Aaron, I'd like to begin with, what can you tell us about the protests by the students today, which really was supposed to be their first day of school?
Yeah, so this is very similar to 2014, the start of the umbrella movement. Quite a few students are out on strike. That includes middle school students all the way through university. So this evening what we have is a very large rally going on at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, where students from all over the city have been bused in for a mass demonstration.
You mentioned that some of these students were very, very young. Are their parents there? What kind of dynamic is with them joining these protests?
Yeah, so we've actually seen students as young as 12 and 13 recently getting arrested, particularly in the last 2 weeks with petrol bombs. And I believe in one case, I think 3 of the students were actually taken away from their home. These kids, and they've been put in a care home until their trial proceeds. So it is creating a lot of sort of new legal ethical questions about it. But you know, I've talked to a few of them, and they're like, my parents, they're either their parents don't know, or they say their parents support them.
Really quickly, can you give us any updates on the protests that took place this past weekend? Because we saw water cannons used and tear gas and other things used by the Hong Kong authorities.
Yeah, we had 2 very different events happen this weekend. The water cannon was deployed for the second time ever. They did use blue dye in it this time. That happened in the area outside of government headquarters, where there was a very intense protest underway. There were petrol bombs there, and then they moved the water cannon as the protesters retreated to another district, which is this big shopping district. The water cannon came along before everyone ultimately fled into the MTR system and then they crossed the harbor. Yesterday was also a very odd and unprecedented day. Protests started at the airport, which currently has an injunction against protesters because of a large demonstration there 2 weeks ago. So that was on the outside of the airport this time, but they did still really managed to disrupt buses from coming in and the train from coming in. But as the police moved in, protesters ended up retreating from the airport. And some of them, because we're on Lantau Island, quite a few hundred people ended up actually making what was ultimately a 20-kilometer trek across this mountainous island to escape police. They walked on the highway and blocked traffic. Some people pulled off and got into buses along the way. And you also saw motorists picking up complete strangers and taking them to safety, because one thing we have seen as well is very, very rapidly increasing police presence. So that day, the police actually went to all the points of escape for them on Lantau Island and had riot police there and were doing ID checks. So no one felt they could get out through the normal train system or through the ferries. So they went into like individual people's cars 2 or 3 at a time, and then onto buses to completely random locations. So it was a very difficult and sort of odd weekend for Hong Kong, but I think one that showed that actually they do still have a lot of support from the public, particularly yesterday. I felt like that people weren't that angry at them for occupying the highway. They actually were very helpful.
Speaking of police presence, these protests don't appear to show any signs of letting up anytime soon. How are people, you mentioned that there seems to be still a lot of support for the protesters, but this is 3 weeks now. Is there a growing concern of a more forceful crackdown?
I think there is a sense that we're sort of heading towards a precipice, but no one quite knows when that will happen or when we'll go over it. But I think we are going to start seeing regularly more police on the streets conducting stop and searches, particularly at train stations. And they're just going to be out and around more, and it'll be a bigger part of people's lives.
And that's Hong Kong-based journalist Aaron Hale. Among other top stories in the world, the U.S. and China imposed new tariffs on each other's exported goods Sunday, the latest skirmish in the lengthy and contentious trade war between the world's two biggest economies. The FBI says the gunman who killed 7 and wounded 22 in Odessa, Texas Saturday acted alone and likely has no ties to any global or domestic terror group. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence said the United States will continue to support Ukraine in the country's conflict with Russia and its right to full territorial integrity. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and with our VOA mobile app. This is VOA News.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Britain is bracing for an explosive week of political battles, which could prove crucial in Britain's proposed exit from the European Union. Lawmakers return from summer break on Tuesday when they will try to seize control of Parliament to prevent Britain leaving the EU without a deal. To dive deeper into what the week may entail, I'm joined by Henry Ridgewell. So, Henry, there have been protests all across the country against Prime Minister Boris Johnson's decision to suspend Parliament. What can you share with us about what is exactly taking place at these protests and who is protesting?
It's a mixture of people protesting. We've seen people on different sides of the debate having counter-protests over the past few months. So those who are in favour of Brexit, who want Britain to leave the European Union as soon as possible, but also on the other side, those who want to stay in the European Union, who are utterly opposed to the government's plans to leave the European Union. What we've seen in recent days is more of a sort of a cross-party protest, cross-political protest against this specific parliamentary step that Prime Minister Boris Johnson has taken in the last week, where he has prorogued, as we say, or suspended Parliament for about 5 weeks, which is due to start next week until mid-October, so just days before the deadline for Britain to leave the European Union on October the 31st. He says it so that he can present a new policy schedule to Parliament, a new Queen's speech, but in reality, most people here see it as a ploy to prevent lawmakers from blocking a no-deal Brexit, from blocking his policy over Brexit. So that is the main reason why many people came out onto the streets in recent days. They say it's an affront to democracy, that MPs should be sitting in the House of Parliament debating and scrutinising this legislation at such a critical time for Britain.
So as you mentioned, people want the MPs, the members of parliament, in the houses to discuss this. What can we expect and what should we look for what's coming out of the parliamentary houses?
Well, it appears that there is a coalition that has formed, a cross-party coalition between primarily the opposition parties, but also some rebel ruling Conservative MPs in the House of Parliament, to try to stop Boris Johnson and the government from leaving the European Union with no deal. They have various different tactics they could use to do that. The first that we'll see in the coming days is an attempt to seize control of parliamentary business. So normally it is the government who decides what is debated and what legislation is passed in the House of Commons. It is possible for other parties and other groups to seize control of that, to decide what should be debated. They will try to do that first. That's their preferred option. The second option is really what's seen more as the nuclear option, is a vote of no confidence in the government itself. Only the leader of the opposition, the Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, could table such a motion. He's so far holding off doing that because it is such a drastic measure, and he's not convinced that he could win that because it would require members of the Conservative Party to vote against their own government. And the third option is that there are about three different court cases ongoing at the moment in different courts in Britain, where different parties have tried to get the judiciary to prevent Boris Johnson suspending Parliament so that the MPs can continue to debate and to legislate surrounding Brexit. So very complex, lots of different strands of parliamentary debate and democratic process going on here, which really underlines just how unprecedented this particular period in Britain's political history is.
Henry Ridgewell is in London. Thank you so much for your insight today.
Good to be with you.
Speaking less than a half hour ago in front of 10 Downing Street, Boris Johnson says that the EU is going to, that the British people are going to leave the EU on October 31st, no ifs, ands, or buts, and that he is sure that they will get a deal before October. According to French reports, more than 1,500 people have attempted to cross the English Channel from France to Britain this year. That's more than double the number from all of 2018. Catherine Field is a Paris-based journalist and joins me to break down what authorities believe is taking place. So, Catherine, let's begin with the numbers. What can you tell us about those who are making the trek across the channel from France to Britain?
Well, so far this year, French authorities say that there have been at least 1,600 migrants rescued at sea. Now, they say that this is mostly in the area around Calais and Dunkirk, and that's at the point where France and the United Kingdom are at its most close. There's only 33 kilometers dividing the two countries, and that is where, in general, that the migrants set off from to try and make it to the United Kingdom.
Now, this is all happening as parliamentary members are heading back from their summer recess, as the discussions about Brexit is coming down the line towards that October 31st deadline. Why do authorities believe that people are trying to leave France for Britain, since it's on its way out of the EU, presumably?
Well, what NGOs are telling us is, first of all, you have the just what happens this time of year. It's nice weather, calm seas. They think they can get over now before we get into the autumn season. Next up, there is a feeling that those border patrols are going to be even more stringent once the United Kingdom leaves the European Union. On top of that, it really is felt that there's much more of an underground network that these migrants can feed into, can live off once they get to the United Kingdom. It's much easier, they feel, to operate within that, your underground market there, where they can get work, get lodgings, much easier there than, say, here in France.
Even though that if the EU and Britain go through with their divorce deal, if they were to remain on the continent per se, they would be able to travel throughout Europe. But if they're only in Britain, that's where they're isolated?
Well, they are isolated indeed, but when you actually look at the numbers who get sent back from the United Kingdom to France, it's very small. In the last year, the United Kingdom has only sent back 65 migrants who've come ashore. So the chances of getting caught are very slim. Unlike here in France, where you really will stand out, it's much harder to get work illegally, it's much harder to get lodgings. So the chances are, yes, you could get to Britain, and the chances are that you'll be able to just blend in much easier. Let's not forget, the southeast of England has a much more mixed population. It's a very world city, if you like, London. So there's much more of an opportunity to be able to just slip in there and get some sort of work.
You mentioned that if the EU and Britain go through with Brexit, that you thought that perhaps there'd be more stringent controls on migration. Have authorities said anything about what they plan to do in the interim as we get closer towards October? Since, as you said, I mean, we're double so far this year over last year.
One thing that the British government has already done is they've handed over some $7 million to French authorities for the upgrade and installation of security equipment. That means CCTV along beaches and ports along that French coast. They also say that within the next few weeks, they may even go further and perhaps there'll be more exchanges between police, special agents, specifically where it comes to the people smuggling networks. Now, at the end of the day, that's where the British and the French say they need to focus.
Catherine Field is a Paris-based journalist. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Steve.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists at the University of Massachusetts Medical School are reporting success in research that may someday help people see things at night that now require the use of very expensive night vision goggles. After injecting a special type of material called upconversion nanoparticles into mice's eyes, the researchers found that the little rodents were able to see in the near-infrared light range. The scientists say the night vision nanoparticles converts low-energy photons from near-infrared light into higher energy light mice and other mammals can see. They reported that the mice maintained their night vision abilities for at least 10 weeks after the injection. Before trying this on humans, the scientists want to improve the safety and sensitivity of the nanomaterials. Researchers presented their findings at a recent meeting of the American Chemical Society. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. India's ambitious mission to the moon has crossed a crucial milestone and is on course to place a probe on the south pole of the lunar surface later this week. Space officials say the landing module detached from the main spacecraft successfully Monday afternoon and is now about 100 kilometers from the moon's surface. It is scheduled to touch down on the moon on Saturday, deploying a 27-kilogram robotic rover on the South Pole. All eyes are now on that landing. If it takes place successfully, India will become the fourth country in the world to make a controlled landing on the moon after the United States, Russia, and China. Space officials say the maneuver is extremely complex. The rover will stay on the moon for 14 days, examining the lunar surface for the presence of water and minerals while studying its topography. The aim is to explore the south side of the moon, which no country has attempted thus far. Iran said on Monday it will take a strong step away from the 2015 international nuclear deal if European countries do not take action to help bypass U.S. sanctions on its oil sales. Iranian officials have set a Friday deadline for instituting the latest pullback from the agreement that has limited its nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. Already, Iran has gone past limits on the amount of enriched uranium it is allowed to stockpile, as well as the level to which it is allowed to enrich uranium. It has not specified what the next steps will be. Iran has also acknowledged for the first time on Monday that a rocket at its Imran Khomeini Space Center exploded after satellite photos showed the blast last week, with an official saying a technical malfunction during a test caused the explosion. And with that, that's going to do it for us on this September 2nd, Labor Day here in the United States. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, engineer John Dryden, and managing editor, Paul X. Alexander, thank you so much for listening. You'll find in-depth coverage of the world events and news at voanews.com. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night, on the go. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Make it a great day.